What if I told you that a closed shipping lane thousands of miles away in the Middle East is actually about to spike your mortgage rate right here in Ohio?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds disconnected, but when you look closely at the underlying mechanics, it becomes pretty clear. The daily financial news we consume, inflation ticks, GDP misses, foreign policy shifts, it's not a collection of isolated events.
Right, it's a single, highly pressurized system.
Exactly. It's all completely interconnected.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is to unpack two seemingly distinct sets of source material for you. One gives us this really granular breakdown of some, frankly, incredibly surprising domestic economic data that just dropped.
Very surprising.
And the other outlines this massive geopolitical theory involving Japan, global energy markets, and the U.S. national debt. And I gotta say, putting them together fundamentally changes the way you look at American prosperity.
It really does. But before we get into it, I should probably mention that our sources today navigate some heavily debated
Oh,
territory.
for sure.
Yeah, they touch on the economic impacts of Donald Trump's tariffs, Joe Biden's green energy policies, and, current U.S. military operations in the Middle East. So, as your analytical guides, our objective is just to map out the economic mechanics these sources are arguing so you can see the bigger picture.
Right. We're definitely not here to take a political stance or, endorse any specific policy.
Exactly. We are simply decoding the arguments and the data presented in the original material.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the immediate, tangible domestic situation because, well, the headline numbers just gave the market serious whiplash.
That's putting it mildly.
Right. I mean, up until very recently, the U.S. economy looked virtually bulletproof on paper. Third quarter GDP growth was roaring at an annualized rate of 4.4%, while consumer inflation was soft. It was sitting at just 2.4%.
Which is, I mean, that combination is the holy grail for central bankers. High growth and low inflation usually signal a deeply robust, sustainable economic environment.
Right, so everyone just expected the momentum would carry forward.
Yeah, that was the consensus.
Then Friday happens, the fourth quarter GDP numbers are released, and they just completely fall off a cliff. The economy decelerated to an annualized rate of just 1.4%.
A massive drop.
Yeah, and I want to dig into the mechanics of why that happened. The source identifies three specific drags that pulled that headline number down so violently. The first is a huge drop in government spending.
Right, and to understand that drop, you have to look at how GDP is mathematically calculated,
Oh.
It measures all final goods and services produced, and government expenditures are a massive chunk of that equation.
Right.
So the source attributes this specific drag directly to the 43-day government shutdown we saw back in October and November.
Oh, right, because when federal agencies freeze, the money just stops.
Exactly. Contracts halt, non-essential personnel are furloughed. That money stops flowing through the system, and it instantly shaves about a full percentage point off the GDP calculation just all on its own.
Wow. Okay, so that's drag number one. The second drag was flat net exports, which is a critical piece we will return to shortly. But the third drag is perhaps the most alarming for the everyday listener.
The consumer data.
Yeah, a massive slowdown in consumption. Consumer spending plummeted to an annualized rate of just 1.5%. That is the weakest reading we've seen since the first quarter.
It's a huge red flag.
And it's happening precisely as the Supreme Court just ruled that the majority of Trump's tariffs are illegal.
Yeah, and that ruling introduces a severe shock to the system. It unravels a major framework of recent public finance. But, it also coincides with another really troubling metric.
The inflation numbers.
Right. The Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, or PCE, came in hotter than forecast at 2.9%.
Okay, wait, let me stop you there because we hear about CPI all the time on the news. Why does the source specifically emphasize PCE jumping to 2.9%? And why does that matter more to the average person buying groceries?
So the Standard Consumer Price Index, or CPI, tracks a fixed basket of goods and updates it only once a year. It's pretty rigid.
Okay.
But PCE is favored by the Fed because it updates its consumer basket dynamically every single month. It accounts for what economists call the substitution effect.
Okay, so what does that look like in practice?
Well, if beef gets too expensive and you switch to buying chicken, PCE captures that real-time behavioral shift. So when PCE jumps to 2.9%, it means that even after consumers try to downgrade or alter their spending habits to save money, they are still getting hit with higher costs across the board.
Oh, wow. So they can't hide from it.
No, they can't. And what's fascinating here is how the source ties that persistent inflation directly back to the policy environment.
Right, the tariffs.
Exactly. The argument presented is that tariffs did not magically avoid causing inflation. The inflationary impact was merely delayed. That sudden jump to 2.9% on the PCE is that delayed impact finally washing through the supply chain and hitting the consumer's wallet.
Which gives us a very different lens to view that massive drop in consumer spending we just talked about.
It really does.
Because the source presents this compelling theory that earlier policy uncertainty actually created an artificial economic boom in the prior quarters. Like, think about your own spending last year or your neighbors.
Yeah, the psychology of it.
Right. If you suspect that tariffs are going to make imported goods skyrocket in price next year, or that, Biden-era tax credits for solar panels and EVs might suddenly vanish, you don't wait to make those purchases.
No, you pull that future demand forward into the present. It creates a temporary aggressive spike in consumption. Millions of Americans basically rushed out to buy big ticket items to front run the anticipated policy changes.
It's essentially panic buying before a storm.
That's a great way to put it.
But the problem with pulling all your 2026 spending into 2025 is that when 2026 actually arrives, well, the credit cards are maxed out.
Yeah, the bill comes due.
Exactly. That 1.5% consumption number in Q4 isn't just a slight dip, it represents an exhausted consumer. The financial bandwidth is completely tapped.
Yeah, the initial data presented this facade of structural strength, but the underlying consumer engine was simply running red hot on borrowed time.
Okay, so that sets a pretty fragile domestic stage. Let's pivot back to the second drag on the GDP we mentioned earlier, flat net exports.
Right, the trade data.
Because the domestic data shows that net exports flattened out in Q4 after shrinking earlier in the year due to some severe tariff-induced swings in pharmaceutical and gold imports.
Yeah, those were weird anomalies.
Yeah, and because those specific anomalies stabilized, the broader U.S. trade deficit actually began to widen again in November and December. And, this is where the conversation usually turns political. We constantly hear complaints about the trade deficit, that buying more from foreign countries than we sell to them is a sign of weakness.
Sure, the conventional narrative is that a trade deficit is a drain on national wealth. But the second source introduces this really counterintuitive argument.
I love this part.
Yeah, they argue that the U.S. trade deficit is not a bug in the system, but rather the deliberate secret engine that sustains the U.S. dollar's global dominance. And the primary anchor of this entire geopolitical arrangement is Japan.
Okay, walk me through the mechanics of that, because how does America, buying millions of Toyotas and electronics, actually fortify the US dollar?
So you have to look at Japan's structural vulnerabilities. Japan is one of the most advanced export-driven economies on Earth, right?
Right.
Yet they possess virtually no natural energy resources within their own borders, zero. To survive, they import raw materials, manufacture highly desirable goods, and export them globally, with the United States acting as their largest consumer.
Okay, making sense so far.
Because of this massive trade imbalance, Japan accumulates an enormous surplus of US dollars.
But they don't just, sit on pallets of physical cash in a warehouse. They have to spend those dollars.
Exactly. And they have to spend them on energy. When the United States abandoned the gold standard in the 1970s, the dollar transitioned to the petrodollar system.
All right, the agreement with the Middle East.
Yes. Agreements were established requiring Middle Eastern nations to price and sell their oil almost exclusively in US dollars. Because Japan imports roughly 95% of its oil from the Middle East, they absolutely must have a constant influx of US dollars just to keep their factories running and their cities powered.
Wait, let me make sure I'm synthesizing this correctly. So the trade deficit that politicians always lament is actually the exact mechanism that funnels dollars to Japan.
Yes.
And then Japan uses those dollars to buy the oil they desperately need from the Middle East. And whatever dollars they have left over, they reinvest back into the United States by purchasing our government debt.
That is exactly how it
I
works.
mean, it sounds like complaining about a leaky pipe in your house when that exact leak is funneling water into your only drinking barrel.
That's a perfect analogy. If we connect this to the bigger picture, that structural loop is what allows the United States to run massive government deficits without immediately crushing its own economy. Japan doesn't just hold those surplus dollars, they deploy them into US treasuries. This makes Japan the largest foreign holder of US debt, currently possessing roughly $1.3 trillion in US treasuries.
$1.3 trillion. That's
Yeah.
a massive safety net for us.
It is. Furthermore, post-World War II agreements limit Japan, along with Germany, from maintaining massive, independent, offensive militaries. They rely fundamentally on the U.S. military for regional protection.
So they basically outsource their national defense to the U.S. And in exchange, they use their export revenue to finance the U.S. government.
Precisely. The source even notes that Japan has actively sacrificed its own domestic economy in the past, specifically in the 1980s and 90s, by overvaluing its currency to ensure the U.S. dollar remained the dominant reserve currency.
Man, it is a deeply entrenched, symbiotic loop. Japan gets energy and security, the U.S. gets cheap imported goods, and a guaranteed buyer for its mounting national debt.
Win-win, historically speaking.
But that entire loop predicates on one vital assumption, right? That the oil keeps flowing. Which brings us to the core geopolitical threat outlined in our sources. What happens when the Middle East store boards up its windows?
Well, the scenario the source outlines is currently unfolding. The U.S. has launched military actions against Iran, resulting in the closure of the Strait of Hormuz.
And for the listener who might not look at a maritime map every day, the Strait of Hormuz is essentially the jugular vein of global energy. A massive percentage of the world's oil passes through this single narrow choke point.
It's a critical bottleneck. With that strait closed and severe international sanctions already paralyzing both Iranian and Russian oil exports, Middle Eastern oil literally cannot physically reach Japan.
So their supply line is just gone.
Japan's primary energy supply is abruptly severed. The source provides a pretty grim timeline. If Japan goes without imported oil for 6 months, their manufacturing-based economy faces total systemic collapse.
6 months to total collapse.
Yeah. You cannot operate heavy industry, maintain logistics networks, or power a highly urbanized society without that energy baseline.
Okay, so Japan is backed into a corner where they have only one viable option left on the board. They have to secure energy from the only remaining major producer capable of supplying them.
The United States.
Right. But American energy is expensive, and Japan needs massive, immediate liquidity to secure it. And this is where that $1.3 trillion in U.S. treasuries comes back into play, doesn't it?
It does. Japan has to start liquidating its strategic financial reserve.
It's like Japan has been holding this massive $1.3 trillion gift card, specifically meant to be spent at the Middle East store. But that store just boarded up its windows. So now Japan has to cash out the gift card to buy from the only store left the United States while also using the leftover cash to build their own security system.
Exactly. Selling off those U.S. treasuries is a matter of sheer national survival. Japan is not dumping American debt as an act of economic warfare or malice. They're simply forced to generate the cash required to buy American oil to keep the lights on.
And there's a massive secondary cost here involving their physical security, right? Because the source highlights that the U.S. is facing significant troop shortages in the Middle East.
Yes. And to compensate for that, the U.S. is moving tens of thousands of military personnel out of Japan to deploy them to the conflict zone.
Wow. So they're leaving.
That removes a cornerstone of Japan's defense strategy. Suddenly, Japan is left highly exposed to major regional adversaries, particularly China.
Oh, man.
So Japan isn't just liquidating U.S. debt to buy oil. They're also forced to use whatever remaining capital they can muster to rapidly build and fund their own independent military. The American security umbrella they relied on for decades is being folded up and relocated.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. We've mapped out the fragile domestic consumer, the mechanics of the petrodollar, and this massive geopolitical shift. But we promised the listener we would explain how a closed strait in the Middle East directly impacts their wallet.
Right, the connection to the individual.
Yeah. So how does Japan selling off U.S. treasuries to buy oil and weapons actually hit the everyday American consumer?
To map that out, we have to look at the death of what the financial sector calls the carry trade.
Okay, the carry trade. Break that down for us.
For the last 30 to 40 years, Japan's domestic economy has been stuck in a state of persistent deflation. Prices were stagnant or falling. To stimulate their economy, the Bank of Japan held their interest rates at roughly 0%.
Meaning capital was essentially free to borrow if you were an institutional investor in Japan.
Precisely. Free money. The carry trade operates like a financial seesaw. Global investors, Wall Street firms, and Japanese institutions would borrow billions of yen in Japan at 0% interest, convert it, and buy U.S. treasuries yielding 3 or 4%.
Right, so they pocket the yield spread with virtually no risk.
Exactly, provided currency and interest rates remain stable. This carry trade has acted as a massive, invisible subsidy for American debt. It generated a constant, insatiable demand for U.S. treasuries, allowing the U.S. government to borrow trillions of dollars at artificially low rates for decades.
But the geopolitical crisis shatters that zero-gravity environment.
It shatters it completely.
Because Japan is completely reliant on imported oil, and the source projects that the Middle East conflict could drive global oil prices past $100 or even $200 a barrel.
And when a nation that imports all of its energy suddenly has to pay double or triple for oil, the cost of manufacturing, transporting, and selling everything inside that country skyrockets, Japan will import severe, aggressive inflation for the first time in a generation.
When a central bank is faced with rampant inflation, they are forced to use their primary tool.
Raising interest rates.
So if the Bank of Japan raises interest rates, the cost to borrow yen is no longer zero. The carry trade mathematically collapses.
Exactly. The investors who borrowed at zero to buy U.S. debt are suddenly facing borrowing costs that wipe out their profit margins. They have to unwind their positions.
They have to sell.
Yes. And simultaneously, as we discussed, the Japanese government is actively selling its own U.S. treasuries to buy American oil and fund its military.
So what does this all mean for the U.S. government? Because they are losing their biggest, most reliable customer, just as they need to borrow more money than ever. The source notes the U.S. already paid over $1 trillion just in interest on its national debt last year.
$1 trillion in interest alone? It's staggering.
If Japan is dumping treasuries and the carry trade is dead, the market is suddenly flooded with supply and starved of demand.
It's the inescapable law of bond markets. To attract buyers, when demand evaporates, the issuer must offer a higher yield. The U.S. government will be forced to drastically increase the interest rates on its treasuries to entice anyone to buy them.
Which cascades instantly into the real economy.
Yes, it does.
So what does this all mean for the listener who is just sitting here hoping mortgage rates drop so they can finally buy a house? Are you saying that because a strait in the Middle East closed, a prospective home buyer in Ohio is going to get priced out of the market?
That is the brutal reality of an interconnected system. Everyday consumer credit, especially mortgage rates, is directly tethered to the yield on U.S. treasuries.
Right.
The source estimates that the disappearance of Japanese demand could easily cause mortgage rates for the average American to spike by 1 to 2 full percentage points.
Oh, wow. 1 to 2% is huge.
It is. A prospective home buyer waiting for a 6% mortgage to soften to 5% might suddenly be staring down an 8% rate. The affordability of housing, auto loans, and business credit fundamentally shifts overnight.
Which brings us full circle to the domestic data we started with. We already established that the American consumer is exhausted. Savings are depleted, the Q4 consumption numbers drop to 1.5%, and inflation is stubbornly sitting at 2.9%.
Yeah, they have nothing left in the tank.
Hitting that tapped-out consumer with an 8% mortgage rate and higher borrowing costs across the board, I mean, that's a recipe for severe economic contraction.
It is. And this raises an important question. How does an individual navigate a macroeconomic environment where the foundational mechanics are basically breaking down?
Yeah. What's the playbook here?
Well, the source is highly critical of traditional defensive strategies. With the cost of debt rising exponentially and cash in the bank aggressively losing its purchasing power to persistent inflation, simply hoarding cash in a savings account yielding 1% is a guaranteed mathematical loss.
So saving money isn't enough anymore.
No. The advice from the source is to shift toward assets that possess the pricing power to rise in nominal value alongside inflation. If the dollar is losing its purchasing power due to rampant government debt issuance and the collapse of foreign demand, you want to hold things that inflate against the dollar.
Like what?
They point specifically to equities and the stock market.
Interesting. And we actually see the blueprint for this in the underlying domestic GDP data, don't we?
We do.
Because while consumer spending cratered, business investment remains surprisingly resilient, heavily driven by the massive capital influx into artificial intelligence infrastructure.
Yeah, the AI boom is real.
The source notes that AI investment alone currently accounts for a staggering 3.5% of overall GDP.
Right. And the logic being that corporate assets and technological infrastructure will simply reprice upwards as the currency debases, it is certainly a riskier environment than the traditional model of holding bonds and cash.
Right.
But when the global reserve currency loses its primary international anchor, the old rules of wealth preservation no longer apply. Understanding the architecture of this transition is crucial. You aren't just reacting to a random inflation print, you are watching the unwinding of a 30-year global financial structure.
Man, let's take a breath and just recap the sheer scale of the mechanics we've unpacked today. We started by looking at a sudden, localized drop in Q4 U.S. GDP and an exhausted domestic consumer whose pull-forward spending finally caught up with
them. Down by the empty pantry.
Yeah. We examined the intricacies of PCE inflation and the immediate fallout of the Supreme Court striking down tariffs. But then we zoomed out, connecting our domestic trade deficit directly to Japan's need for Middle Eastern oil via the petrodollar.
The leaky pipe filling the barrel.
Exactly. And finally, we traced how a closed shipping lane in the Strait of Hormuz forces Japan to liquidate its trillion-dollar U.S. Treasury reserves, killing the carry trade, and inevitably driving up the cost of a mortgage for a family in Ohio.
It illustrates perfectly that domestic economic health cannot be divorced from geopolitical stability. They are the same system.
And that is exactly why we do these deep dives for you. Because while the broader economic vibes feel shaky and the headline data points seem contradictory, understanding these underlying currents is everything.
Absolutely everything.
Grasping how the Bank of Japan's yield curve directly impacts American housing affordability is the difference between being blindsided by inflation and making informed strategic decisions about your own assets.
It empowers you to anticipate the systemic shifts rather than just suffering the consequences of them.
Exactly. Now, as we wrap up today, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Building on the profound shifts we've discussed, we've seen how the absolute dominance of the U.S. dollar, and by extension, American domestic prosperity, was built on a very specific post-Cold War arrangement with dependent allies like Japan.
Right.
But if raw survival forces those allies to sell off our debt, rebuild their own militaries, and forge entirely independent economic paths, what happens to the concept of the American superpower? Can a nation truly maintain ultimate global leverage if its closest friends are forced by necessity to stop funding its currency?
It forces a total reevaluation of what makes a currency a global reserve in the 21st century.
It certainly does. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden forces shaping our global economy. We'll catch you next time.